Canadian politics is, you know, it's something I talk about a lot. It's something that you'll read about in Canadian newspapers, of course. You'll hear about it on the CBC. You would think, based on how much we, you know, focus on it, that it's something that people really care about. But if you look at the numbers, and as a publisher, I got to look at the numbers, what you realize is that Canadian politics is a niche interest. It's like frisbee golf or quilting. I mean, these are things that small communities of people care a lot about and that most people have no emotional investment in whatsoever. But do you know what is not niche? A topic that everybody has pretty big feelings about? Justin Trudeau. Those who hate him, hate him. And those who don't hate him, well, they don't really like him anymore. And I know, you know, polls schmolls, but like, have you seen the polls? The Conservatives have opened up a 19-point lead over the Liberals. That is the largest national lead that Abacus has ever measured for the party. But this is bigger than polls because this is bigger than politics. And like I said, people might not care much about politics, but they care about Trudeau because they associate him with something that more and more people really do care about. Something that is powerful and growing and driving people's emotions in a very personal way. It is a much bigger topic than the niche topic of Canadian politics, and that is a growing enmity and hatred for quote-unquote wokeness. And there is no individual in Canada who personifies that wokeness more than Justin Trudeau. Here's how writer Stephen Marsh describes this all to me.
You cannot really, in my opinion, underestimate the sheer unpopularity of identity politics. I mean, it's extraordinary.
So isn't that exactly what Polyev represents on an emotional level?
So when he says about ordinary people and extraordinary people, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What matters is that they pulled every book written before 2008 from the library system in Mississauga. And every rational human being with children who actually has to send their children to school says, what are you doing? That's what's happening.
If he can personify what I think is not just a rejection, but a disgust with however people perceive wokeism or anti-racism, DEI, this growing rejection of all of these currents that have dominated so much of the conversation, if he becomes the embodiment of that...
He'll be in power for a decade.
He'll be in power for a decade. That is what writer Stephen Marsh told me. And that thought struck me with all of the force of a simple, basic truth. It's already over. Pierre Poilievre is already our next prime minister. And he may be our prime minister for a long time. And so today we're going to dare to speculate and hypothesize. What is this going to be like, this coming decade of conservative rule in Canada? Stephen Marsh joins me from here in Toronto, journalist Paul Wells from Ottawa, and journalist Jen Gerson from Calgary. I did not ask them onto the show to talk about politics. I asked them to help me understand how life in Canada is about to change for everyone.
Jen Gerson, I am a co-founder with The Line, and I'm based in Calgary.
I'm Paul Wells. I'm in Ottawa, and you can find me at paulwells.substack.com.
I'm Stephen Marsh, and I'm a writer, and I live in Toronto.
All right, here's the premise for today's conversation. We are just going to skip 2 years of horse race punditry and commentary. It's over already. Barring some unforeseeable act of God, Pierre Poilievre is not just going to win. He is going to stomp to victory. It's going to be brutal. A majority. But beyond that, the Liberals will likely be rebuilding from close to scratch, and this country might be looking at a good long period of right-wing rule. What does that look like?
A lot of Canadians perceive this government, rightly or wrongly, to have gone fairly radically left, and a crushing majority by Pierre will be seen as a rejection of that shift. Does that make sense?
Paul,
even a decisive election of a quality of conservative government, I don't think reflects an ideological shift in the electorate. I think it reflects firing the incumbents. Poiliev is going to have to sort of build legitimacy for whatever it is he plans to do day by day.
Nothing has changed here. We're just doing what we always did. We're just getting rid of the old guys. And in fact, the electorate has been static throughout all of this is the general idea. Stephen, you were saying something very different to me in a private conversation that I'm going to make public, that something actually has changed. People are thinking very differently than when we were all basically, when Trudeau was on the cover of international magazines, and we were all feeling quite hopeful about this government.
I do think one thing has changed, like this conservative turn among young people is kind of unprecedented. I mean, that's really what I was talking about. And that is something that I don't think really any political commentary is really fastened onto, because that's not just happening in Canada. But there does seem to be this rightward shift among young people all over the world. What will the situation in the United States be? What will the situation in the world be? And how will Canadians be responding to that reality?
All right, you've all done your parts to make this as amorphous and murky as possible. Let's try to bring this down to a lived experience level, because Canada is broken, folks, and people just need to look outside their damn windows and they can see it for themselves. I'm not talking about ideology. I suppose I'm talking about policy. But from a human level, I think that we are talking about housing and a few other things.
Yeah.
Our editor-in-chief was present at a conservative get-together at the True, Strong, Free, North, Proud. What is it? The used to be the Manning Institute. What's it called?
Canada Strong and Free, I think.
There we go. Strong and Free. I don't know that anyone has heard this yet, but she recorded what was said there, and Poiliev spoke. Here's a little bit of what that sounded like.
I will link the number of infrastructure dollars a big city gets to the number of houses it allows to be built. We're going to require every single federally funded transit station have high-density apartments around it so that our young people can live right next to the bus or the train. And then there's this big empire of big, ugly government buildings, 37,000 of them, and many of them are empty with so-called work from home. I'm going to sell off 15% of these buildings, and it warms my heart to think of the beautiful family pulling up in their U-Haul to their wonderful new home in the former headquarters of the CBC.
Okay, so there you have it. We'll all live in the former CBC headquarters.
Can you imagine? Do you think young people want to live in government buildings? It is funny because he's pegged his entire election on an inherently insoluble policy issue that he's not going to be able to solve. Like, what happens after that fails is actually a really interesting question. I mean, everything you heard in that, Tim, is not going to work.
Okay, but that sounded like some policy suggestion. That this is how he's going to do it.
I agree that essentially we have a generational problem on housing. And the generational problem on housing is going to be resolved by massive building, massive policy changes. But realistically, it's also going to be solved by a lot of boomers dying off, bluntly. That's going to be part of it. And then the other part of the housing conversation is going to have to be tied to immigration, right? Like, you can't maintain the high levels of immigration we have if you can't build to accommodate them. So these sort of things together are going to chip away at the housing problem. But you're correct in noting that's not going to happen 18 months after the election. We've spent 20, 30 years getting ourselves into the current housing pickle. If you're voting Pierre Poiliev thinking that you're going to own your first condo 18 months after he gets elected, that's not a realistic framework. You're right, he's pegged himself around an insoluble policy problem, but at least he's acknowledging it's a problem. And I think that that is probably what's speaking to a lot of young people. Also, the connection, this new sort of forging of conservatism around urbanism, that is a potent emotional position for him to take.
To fairly summarize what he says he's going to do, he's going to incentivize municipalities by pegging federal funds to removing red tape to allow for building. He's going to sell off government buildings so that, I guess, these government buildings could be converted into housing. Is that real? Like, it's emotional to say there's too much red tape. That's what's stopping. I thought that it was the fact that money's no longer free is why builders don't want to build any housing anymore. Paul, what do you think?
The housing policy is the purest claptrap. This idea that the federal government has a substantial funding lever that it could use to reward or punish individual municipalities is fantasy. It's a nice amount of money. It's not enough to inflect their choices. Incidentally, individual municipalities have a pretty modest influence themselves over whether housing gets built or not in any given year. I mean, the silliest thing about the private member's bill that he's put before Parliament is that this lever that he brags about would only be exercised in 22 Canadian municipalities. And he's developed the bad habit of showing up in municipalities that are not on that list of 22 and bragging about what he's going to do. His own bill doesn't give him any say over what happens in Pointe-Claire, Quebec, as somebody should have mentioned to him before he walked on stage in Pointe-Claire, Quebec, and bragged about his bill.
I got to rebut a little bit of that, because I think you're mostly correct. But I would observe that shortly after Pierre Poilievre announced this policy, the Liberals more or less copied it, and they started threatening to withhold funding in Calgary. And this led to Calgary going, oh, shit. And they eventually, I think, they did what the federal government wanted them to do. And I think that there now is attached a $228 million housing file to something like 6,800 houses here in Calgary. So do I think that there is a single magic bullet to the housing crisis? Absolutely not. There isn't. And I think that if you're pretending that this single policy by the Conservatives is going to fix it, yeah, that is misguided and wrong. That's politically motivated and emotionally motivated. But to say that there are no levers, or there are no single things that the federal government could or should be doing, or that this isn't one of those potential levers. I mean, I've just seen in my own city play out how that lever actually worked, and it did.
Stephen?
Here's what I worry about. I mean, because what we see in America is that they've essentially entered a post-policy phase of their politics. They don't talk about policy. They don't actually have any solutions to anything. Nothing can get solved, and instead they resort to hyper-partisanship and extreme sort of moralistic positions that have nothing to do with reality. And the question that really faces Canada, the broadest question, is how can we prevent that from happening here? How can we have a conservatism and a liberalism that are both policy-driven, ideas-driven, and somehow remaining in fact? And what worries me about this play of Poilievre is that he must on some certain level know that both deregulation and government funding both don't seem to solve this problem, that it's actually a very intractable problem that doesn't have solutions. And so what happens when it fails? What happens when the economic policies that he's promoting actually fail? What worries me is then the turn to, shall we say, the radical politics that we're seeing play out in the rest of the world. Like when housing problems fail, when these problems fail, the first thing they do is blame immigrants. And then the next thing is government salaries.
So the answer is clearly to promise nothing and never try to solve anything, because that will prevent that same kind of downward turn, right?
Well, reasonable solutions to actually soluble problems, honesty with the population, seems to me like, I think we're a reasonable enough country that we're actually entitled to honesty from our leaders. I know that sounds like a crazy idea, but I think we're an educated enough population that we can actually understand, like, this is really intractable, and solving it, it's not going to happen because we just suddenly deregulate the cities.
What we agree about is that this is not going to be solved a year into a new government. You know, we don't even need to necessarily contend with this other idea that by selling off ugly government buildings, that's going to solve the housing crisis or even make a dent in it. I mean, there's a huge amount of office space that has become available, and the kind of napkin math that people have, like, well, why don't we turn that into housing? Because it's incredibly expensive to make that happen, and nobody's actually investing in that. So why would that suddenly start happening if these government buildings were sold off? It's got nothing to do with the problem at hand. And I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's more maybe our, or certainly my preoccupation, and maybe ours than everybody else's, but he does gesture towards one thing that he brings up all the time, which is that he's going to defund the CBC. And then we'll all be living in their headquarters, maybe yes, maybe no. But he certainly could do that. He certainly could pursue that. And he's also promised that the bailout money that's going into the newspaper industry, that's going to go too. Everything that we're discussing, will our ability to know about it be compromised? Because one thing he certainly could do is deliver a death knell to the cliche of the collapsed media. He could sort of stomp on the grave. But to do away with the CBC is a big deal. Is that going to happen? Paul, you wanted to say something?
I've been going on the assumption for more than a year that when he says defund, he's taking care to use a word that's as meaningless in the CBC context as it is in the policing context. It could actually mean increasing funding, which is what it's meant in most cities that promise to defund the police. I increasingly think I would really not want to be him on the day when he announces he's not shutting down the CBC. His militant voter base would eat him alive. So I think there's a very good chance he could shut the CBC down.
Jen?
I have had conversations with people who I think are representative of the conservative base. They do legitimately expect him to defund the CBC, and defund, I think, is an Paul's correct to note the use of the word defund. That can mean a lot of things, including selling off the CBC to private corporations, for example. My position to them is always like, okay, you do that, then what are you going to replace it with? Because bluntly, the private media sector is going to collapse and is collapsing. Already, significant swathes of the country, including the swathes of the country that are disproportionately voting for you, so rural Canada, for example, is already radically underserved by any kind of media organization. And the sorts of things that are popping up in the vacuum of any kind of professional media class is, for example, Facebook groups, increasingly conspiratorial Facebook groups. You cannot govern a Canada that is informed this way. Nobody can. You will be eaten by this particular dragon that you are choosing to ride. So if you want to collapse or defund the CBC, you need to make sure that there is the infrastructure or some kind of legitimate news organization capacity, something there, so that you can continue to run something resembling a cohesive nation state.
So what's that going to be? Because I agree with Paul that he has made this such a pillar of his campaign, his enmity to the CBC. But I agree with you too, Jen. I've said this again and again when he has blamed Trudeau of bailing out the media so that they could serve Trudeau. I actually don't think that's why the Liberals did that. I think a big reason is exactly what you say, that to actually allow the media to completely disappear would be to throw us into information chaos. And how the hell do you get any narrative out there if we are in that space? And that's a problem no matter who's governing. Stephen?
You want your enemies alive but not kicking, right? And that's exactly how we could keep the CBC, like just starve it. It's a lot easier for him to govern without media. He knows how to rule Twitter and Facebook. He's in a position right now where he wins both ways. People hate the left. They absolutely hate the progressive left. That's why he's winning. So he actually needs them to survive in some kind of threadbare scarecrow form that he can kick around.
He needs a punching bag.
He needs a punching bag, and the left is absolutely willing to serve.
I mean, look, it's one thing to try and manage a narrative in the current landscape when you're dealing with a hodgepodge of media outlets, legitimate, non-legitimate, talk shows, whatever. That's one thing. If you move 40 million people into effectively an information vacuum, and it won't be 40 million because there will be, you know, islands of mainstream media, but let's say 30 million, 20 million people into an information vacuum, I think that you start to lose touch with some of those people and some of those groups and some of his own base starts to lose touch with consensus reality.
That's how you want them.
No, it's not.
That's how you want them without consensus reality. That makes them so much easier to govern.
No, Stephen, because he won't control the consensus reality. There is no top-down mechanism by which to impose a consensus reality on the government. The point I just wanted to get back to on the CBC is, like, the way out here isn't defunding or necessarily selling the CBC off or anything else. The obvious way out for the conservatives that would serve their base and serve some of their legitimate issues with the CBC, and some of their issues with the CBC, to my mind, are legitimate, not all of them, but some of them, is with a thorough, in-depth, and scathing mandate review. The point with the CBC is that you could double its revenue and it wouldn't necessarily fix its problems, because the problems lie in its lack of clarity and certainty with what we as Canadians are asking the CBC to do. And you resolve that through a very thorough mandate review. And I think a mandate review should, I mean, personally, the way I would structure the CBC, I would not make it compete with corporate media. I would see it as fundamentally non-competitive. I would have them see themselves as more of like a public service or a library of journalism that can become a repository of journalism values and approaches to the world. I would want to see them do training. And then what I would want the CBC to do is I would mandate that the CBC has a certain number of reporters in every community over 100,000 people in this country.
Hear, hear. Stephen?
His problem with him is none of that. His problem is ideological capture. That the CBC, it does not represent anything even remotely approaching the political nature of the country.
No, the problem with the CBC is ideological capture. And if the CBC can't maintain the support of the taxpayer, it's inevitably going to lose its funding.
Well, that's where we are.
The problem that you're trying to solve, Jen, is not the problem he's trying to solve.
No, that's right. But that's what I'm trying to point out here. I'm trying to point out to conservatives who may be listening to the show, all three of them, that in fact the problems are aligned. That there is actually a solution both to their problems with the CBC and to the informational vacuum in a way that doesn't involve overly subsidizing failing private media corporations. And the problem is to try to address that through the CBC mandate.
Jen, when we do the episode about the first 100 days of me and you in charge of Canada, we can address that. But the CBC is valuable to PR. Yeah, don't give us that job. The phenomenon that we're describing of everybody losing consensus reality is already well underway. And when you put your pedal to the metal and just accelerate that rapidly, very quickly, which I think there's a very good chance he will do, nobody on this panel knows what the hell will happen then.
But also, just to be clear, the CBC is not contributing to consensus reality. It is an ideologically captured institution that is listened to by increasingly fewer number of people, exactly because it does not reflect Canadian reality.
I hear Stephen's complaint from a substantial number of the CBC employees I know.
I want to move on to another major policy plank. He's made some very big promises about how this is going to be different, and that has to do with his approach to crime and drugs. Let's listen to what he had to say to a group of other conservatives.
The same 40 offenders were arrested 6,000 times in 1 year. That's 150 arrests per offender per year. We wonder why crime is raging out of control in that part of the country. You know, and it's not that much better here. Just the other day, there was a holdup. A robber came up to a man, pulled a gun at another man and said, "Give me all your money." The man said, "Do you know who I am?" The robber said, "No." The man said, "I'm Justin Trudeau." The robber said, "In that case, give me all my money." But joking aside, taxpayer-funded so-called safe supply has led to more addiction, not less, the exact opposite of what we were promised. Under Trudeau, overdose deaths have gone up by 300% in British Columbia. Recently, they decriminalized heroin, crack, cocaine, and illicit fentanyl. And the problem gets worse and worse and worse. What we actually have is a misery industry. Every time you speak out against it, there's all of these experts that jump in front of media cameras saying that they've proven that these policies work. And every year, it gets worse and worse and worse. But these agencies and interest groups collect bigger and bigger checks from the government to perpetuate the misery that they helped create in the first place.
Okay, so it falls to me first to just do a quick, a couple of those things are just simply not true. 40 offenders were arrested 6,000 times in 1 year. There's a complicated way in which he juked that stat, but it's not accurate. And then his argument that the safe supply can be directly linked to overdose deaths going up 300% in British Columbia, I don't even think that's subject to like interpretation. The safe supply program is not widespread enough for it to even be credible that's even a possibility. That being said, this is a major issue for Canadians. They're associating a bunch of different issues together when they're seeing tent encampments, when they're seeing an opioid epidemic throughout the country, homelessness, all these things kind of combine to a conception that this country has gone to hell, Canada is broken, Pierre is going to fix it. Is there going to be any demonstrable or noticeable change when it comes to what people see when they look at the downtown of any Canadian city 100 days or a year after Pierre Poilievre takes power?
When people start talking about crime and punishment, and the same reason why the CBC has made itself its own punching bag, as a result of the ideological capture problems, the crime and punishment side has itself become a politically charged issue for a reason. And that's because people are seeing tent encampments, people are seeing more homelessness, people are seeing more trash in the streets, people are feeling less safe in their environments. People are noticing the cars are getting stolen, people are noticing property crimes go up. And then when you bring this up and you say, look, I don't feel safe in my community anymore, they get told by experts, yeah, but violent crime is down by 5-6%, right? Like, your perceptions are wrong and your feelings are wrong and the objective facts are this, this, this. And of course, a lot of the facts that a lot of people who are arguing against point out are themselves sort of cherry-picked issues. I mean, we talk about ideological capture in the CBC. Do we really think that there's no ideological capture on the safe supply issue or safe consumption side issues? Of course there is. And so people feel like they can't have their actual concerns, legitimate or otherwise, addressed and openly dealt with. And that's why so many of these issues gain such potent political and emotional resonance. And that's why people like Pierre can take advantage of them without disputing your fact checks there, Jesse.
Over to you, Stephen.
I don't know about you guys, but I blame the mayor. Whenever there's a rise in crime, I blame the mayor or the police chief. I don't ever blame the feds. Again, it's one of these things like, oh, you're going to solve the drug problem, are you? Like, oh, you're going to solve the housing and the drug problem. You've got the answer. We all know that these are incredibly intractable, very difficult problems that are highly resistant to policy from any angle. Like, we tried the drug war. It really didn't work. These safe injection sites, I am fully open to, like, let's look at them and let's put them under the microscope and see if they work. And I think they are failing.
But, Stephen, can we also just make sure that we have enough judges to make sure that crimes are prosecuted in a timely manner? And can we maybe reconsider some of the recent crime bills that made it easier for repeat offenders to get probation? I mean, could we maybe hire more cops? I mean, again, this gets into the problem that if I don't have a policy solution that solves everything, every policy solution is a waste of time. And yet we know that there are compounding policy solutions to a lot of these problems. And we know that because we didn't have a lot of these perception of crime issues even 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Well, the fact that you have to say perception of crime really says it all.
But it's perceptions you have to deal with, and it's emotions you have to deal with in politics. You can't just say that those emotions go away by saying, okay, but this particular measure of homicide's gone down in Toronto over the last 2 years.
Why not? That seems to be like a perfectly reasonable solution.
Because that doesn't help if my car's been broken into 3 times last week. Right? You need to acknowledge where people are on this.
This is true. Perception of crime matters when you're trying to get into office. And I think that we can have a real difficult and non-conclusive conversation as to what's going to actually help the opioid epidemic in terms of if we, the way that we often talk about this, I mean, here or on the CBC or elsewhere, is that we're trying to actually solve the problem of people dying from these drugs or being addicted to these drugs. But let's face facts here. For a lot of people, that is not their primary concern. Their primary concern is, how do we get these people out of my sight?
Yeah.
And I think that Pierre Poilievre is appealing to those people who don't necessarily, he's saying things that are not true, that we need to pursue rehab instead of safe supply. So how many beds of rehab is he promising to open up? What massive investment into CAMH and other organizations like that is he promising? Nothing at all. Putting aside the issue as to whether or not rehab actually works. But no, there's not going to be some major capital investment into opening up rehab beds. But he might be able to bulldoze these people out of sight and out of mind. And I think that a lot of people, that would be enough in terms of why they might vote for him. Paul, what do you think?
So what Pierre Poilievre is doing as opposition leader is what every opposition leader does and what arguably they should. Before an election, they find the things that hurt worst in the country. They stand in front of it and they say, I'll fix it. It's hardly surprising or outrageous that he is complaining about a serious housing shortage in the country. It's hardly surprising that he's complaining about unprecedented immigration levels with unprecedented temporary migrant levels on top of that, with no plan to deal with that. And it's hardly surprising that he's complaining about an opioid epidemic that is a massive human tragedy that has been the second largest killer of Canadians after the pandemic during the time that Justin Trudeau has been prime minister. Say he's prime minister for 4 years, which is not something I would guarantee. But if it were to happen, I think a lot of these things would get measurably better during the time that he was prime minister, because we'd be getting further and further away from the chaos of the pandemic. But I note that a year ago, he was saying, don't do drug policy like British Columbia, do it like Alberta. And he's not saying that anymore, because Alberta in 2023 had the worst, deadliest year of the opioid pandemic that it has ever had. I get to notice when his alternative case turns into a massive death spree.
Just to represent a point of view that is not with us today is when Garth Mullins was on the show talking about safe supply, the point that I recall him making many times is that you can't really measure safe supply unless you're actually giving safe supply of the drugs that people want. If you're giving people drugs that they would rather sell to get the drugs that they do want, they're going to divert those safe supply drugs and they're going to get drugs that might be toxic.
Paul, you very correctly noted out that Alberta noted a 25% increase to like a record number of opioid deaths last year in 2013. I looked that up. You're totally correct. It's 1,400. But what I think it's important to parallel, if you're going to parallel BC's approach versus Alberta's approach, I also think it's worthwhile to note that BC also suffered a record number of opioid deaths in 2023, 2,383 in 2022 and something like 2,500 last year as well. So we're seeing opioid deaths rise in both of these jurisdictions, despite the fact that they're taking different ideological approaches here.
Let me respond.
Sure.
Then don't propose Alberta as the remedy to British Columbia.
Okay, sure.
I'm done. See, I can give you a short answer.
No, that's fair. And I think that's a fair point. But I mean, personally, I look at this and I'm like, we actually have two relatively, not totally similar, but relatively similar jurisdictions that are trying different approaches. And I think that in a confederation, that's probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing that we have different provinces trying different approaches and seeing what works over a period of time. But anyway, and I remain agnostic as to what the right approach is.
There's one last area I want to get into. What we have left out of our conversation largely is that there is a wider world out